You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Greetings, everyone. It's Fran here, again with Kylie Crabb, and it's the 14th Sunday after Pentecost and proper 17, depending which way you look at it. And Kylie and I will be talking about Mark 7, 1 to 8, 14 to 15, 21 to 23, and James 1, verses 17 to 27. And the themes between both these readings, you'll know if you've read them already, intersect and overlap and connect quite nicely. They don't always, do they, Kylie? So we're going to start with the Mark Gospel reading. We have missed Mark for about 5 weeks. And last time we saw him, I believe Jesus was walking on water. So can you lay it out for us? Remind us, Kylie, where we are in chapter 7.
Yeah. Nice to get our heads back into the Mark headspace after lots of weeks of John or whichever other readings you've been thinking about. So this is still in the kind of first half of Mark's gospel. You might remember that we're looking at the start here of chapter 7. So in chapter 6, we've had big ticket items like the feeding of the 5,000, which was in fact directly after Herod's banquet. So we got this contrast between the banquet at which John the Baptist's head is served and the feeding of the 5,000. And then Jesus walking on water, as Fran said. And now we're moving into this story, which is all building up, as you'll probably know, to the important moment in chapter 8 when Jesus turns to his disciples and says, "Who do people say that I am? And who do you say that I am?" And Peter makes his confession of faith that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah. Before Jesus then turns, sort of, yes, you've achieved. So having set up Jesus's identity through all of these early chapters, there's this kind of moment where, yes, you've got this, but then things turn a bit with the first passion prediction, and realizing what kind of Messiah we're talking about is perhaps different from how people might have expected.
So here it's about Jesus' identity, very broadly speaking, thus far, and this is very much pushing back within his own tradition in explicit ways.
Yeah.
Is that right? That's how I would.
Yeah, I think totally. Yeah.
And one thing I think we do need to look at with this one, Kylie, isn't it, is that we are Gentiles reading into a Jewish conversation.
Yes.
And so I think we quite glibly sometimes forget that Jesus didn't start Christianity. Jesus was a Jew in conversation and conflict at times with his own tradition and his own elders and people.
Yeah.
You know, we can speak about Pharisees in very disparaging terms. That is essentially anti-Jewish, really, at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a key insight of this, and in fact of also the James reading we might get to later on, and we will get to later on. But here, you know, like there's this kind of debate about the practice of the law that's going on that could really easily just be reduced into some kind of sort of sectarian debate or some kind of anti-Jewish rhetoric. But of course, all the characters that we're talking about here are Jewish, including Jesus and his disciples. And so we're sort of listening in on a conversation that is, in fact, much like the conversations we might have about the, you know, the best way or the way that we've discerned how to live out our faith according to our tradition, which is what the topic of debate is here, really.
Yeah, and that's always a conversation, isn't it, about the gospel and living it out in a particular time and living within a tradition and which parts of those tradition are living and life-giving and sustaining and, you know, in what ways they might need to be tweaked, to put it popularly, or, you know, modified.
Yeah. It's definitely important stuff about how we think about translating this into a contemporary context in a way that that really honors what's at stake here, so that you've got the citation from Isaiah, which is about, a prophetic critique of the way that people are living out their faith, which is the kind of critique that we would address to one another and to ourselves within the debate. But we get this distinction here between the commandment of God and human tradition, which might need a little bit of unpacking maybe. There certainly in the first century, we have other sources like Josephus, a Jewish historian, who talk about different groups within Judaism exactly having this debate, actually, and Pharisees being described as people who follow in the tradition of the fathers. So here we have the tradition of the elders, so the language is slightly different, but it's potentially a similar kind of idea about a Pharisaic tradition that is trying to interpret scripture and ethos, the way of living that comes from it, in a particular tradition that is handed on from one to another. And that is maybe being used as a lifting off point for criticism here, for critique, that the Pharisees are known to do this kind of interpretive tradition. And the Mark and Jesus is drawing a distinction here between the commandment of God and holding to sort of like merely human tradition, how that might be seen. I don't know, how do you feel like that hits the ground with us, Fran?
Oh, well, I think putting it more in simpler terms is it's about hypocrisy and consistency.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's always, always a conversation in human action, and we are very, very quick to point out inconsistencies in other people and, you know, less so in ourselves. So,
I feel another gospel kind of reference
know,
in there somewhere.
I might be moving to James very quickly. But but that whole discerning of what is God's commandment and what is a human precept,
yeah,
you know, difficult. Difficult.
Difficult. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and we get this bit, I mean, it's worth mentioning just in terms of like picky little exegetical bits that would be good to mention. There, people will notice that the lectionary reading just like includes little clumps of verses with chunks missing between, which it's always worth reading the whole lot through to see what's being missed. And sometimes it's for a good, you know, because it's about something else and this is a way to truncate it. But there is a quite confusing bit in the middle there, I think, like in verse 11, where we're talking about this idea of Corban. And they don't mean like Jeremy Corbyn from the UK. This is a word for something being a gift. So this is the Aramaic word for gift. And so what we've got going on here is a contrast bit. You see the kind of forthright language in verse 9 where Jesus says to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition. So he's drawing a really stark contrast between them. But the tradition that you kind of need to know about that's behind it is an idea of gifting one's goods as an offering, which means that it can't be used for anything else. So,
an offering to the temple or to the institution.
Yes,
or,
yes.
Yeah, to the synagogue.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So you're naming something as a gift, as a some kind of, you know, sacrifice in a way that you've made, but sort of naming it that, and then it can't be used for anything else. And that the problem that the Mark and Jesus is getting at here is a way in which that's being leveraged in order to stop support for one's parents. So he's contrasting the commandment to honor your father and mother, and with this kind of misuse of a tradition of making it so that possessions that can't be used for anything else and therefore can't be used to support the father or mother in particular circumstances. So it's quite specific kind of social historical background behind this that seems quite confusing possibly to us now.
But to me it sounds very similar to propping up the institution, like sort of in the face of terrible accusations of wrongdoing by the church, that the church then seeks to protect itself. You know, this is the church wanting to put it – oh, not the church. This is the institution wanting to put itself first in the face of other need. And the need of the least.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And people using it to do that so that they're, not supporting their parents. So, yes, definitely. So that's an important thing to notice. And then, of course, we get this this interesting stuff about, you know, it's let you understand, like it's really forthright. Listen to me, all of you, and understand there's nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile.
And yes, and that whole idea of the human heart being, you know, that's where those things come from. When they're coming out of us, they are coming from our heart. And it's not heart in the popular sense we understand it as emotion separate from our heads in that unhelpful dichotomy we've got. But it's biblically and Jewishly understood, the heart is where decision and mind and wholeness, the wholeness of the person or motivation is seated. And so, yeah, therefore, if you are wrongly oriented, or then what comes out from you is defile, is it's possible for it to be defiled.
Yeah. And to contrast the kind of defilement that might come from external things with this list here that we get in verses 21 to 22, this is a traditional vice list that we get in other, you might remember them from sections of some of Paul's letters as well. Yeah. So this is a list of things that are bad news in a range of ways. And might, I mean, you know, without going over the top, also kind of potentially invite a bit of reflection too about these things all being on the same plane in a way, you know, deceit and pride and envy and folly.
The same as murder.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is all in the list of things to avoid. Yeah. Or I think we sometimes get a bit more caught up on, you know, adultery and fornication.
Oh, we do.
Then we might worry about pride and folly and slander. And the other thing that's really interesting about these kind of the themes that come out of this passage is, of course, that it sets up really nicely the story that comes in the next little passage, which is the lectionary reading for next week about the Syrophoenician woman's faith, and that there'll be an interesting and forthright dialogue between the Syrophoenician woman and Jesus in that interaction on sort of some of these similar issues, really.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find the link at our website, fatherwell.com.au.
Right, let's move to James. Now, James was written, we think, no, we've researched, later than you might think. I think around 80 to 100 or 120
maybe,
after Jesus.
Well, there's a bit of a conversation to be had about who is this James and what's the nature of this epistle. So, Fran, who's the person that we think of with James that it might be like kind of named after?
Well, according to my reading, it's Jesus' half-brother and actually it's Jacobos. It's in the original, it's Jacobos.
So that's the Greek for James.
However, that would then, people would be quick to note, not make a great deal of sense if it was written in the later year 80 to 120. Yeah, yeah. So I think what we can perhaps assume or presume is that it was written in the flavour of character of this James by a later writer. And we do hear Paul refer to this James in Galatians, not terribly positively, as you might not be surprised to learn. So Paul was writing in a time, I think, close to the Jerusalem Council in about 50, where they were going to decide whether or not new Christians needed to be circumcised or not. And Paul, Paul obviously didn't think that they should be, but James did. And so we hear in Galatians 2 and I think Galatians 5 some disparaging remarks
bit
about
James. Bit of passion.
James.
Yeah, people will remember that Galatians is a very passionate letter about this conflict.
Yeah.
So we have like a whole lot of historical issues, right, in how we're going to read this text. And even in just that description, you know, you can hear in that for people who are familiar with the various New Testament passages that we have to move around a bit to reconstruct this story. And some of that's coming from Acts and the story of the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15. And some of it's coming from Paul's letters. And it means that there is this sense of some fracture in the early church over these questions about legal practice, and then, you know, questions about which dietary laws need to be followed and whatnot also come through here. And so the question is, I mean, some people might want to suggest that the letter of James is written by the historical James, but I think that it's really the consensus is that it's not written by that historical James, the person we know from those from Acts and from Paul's presentation of his position. But it is still interesting to look at like where this fits in Christian tradition, this letter, and what kind of perspective, like Fran's saying about the about this being written maybe from the perspective of that kind of part of the church, what someone's trying to put forward as a different consideration in Christian life.
But by the same token, it would also be true to say that this wasn't written on the occasion of a community, a particular community having grappling with issues in the ways that Corinthians was written, for example, so that we've got a lot of more general statements from wisdom tradition in this letter.
Yeah, we have some of this, and we also, I mean, one of the things is, I mean, I guess when you have one of Paul's letters, yeah, and you get like the kind of flavor of his interaction with the people that, you know, the communities that he founded, like in Corinth or Galatia, you get the passion and the kind of personal relationship there that maybe gives us more of a sense of what's going on in the Corinthian community and whatnot. Here we have something that's maybe a bit different, but it also might give us some, like some people say, well, there's evidence that it might be from Jerusalem or somewhere like that because of some of the economic kinds of conflicts that are referred to at various points and stuff. That stuff sort of presumes some bad behavior and whatnot that might have been going on amongst people in, you know, landlords in Jerusalem and so on. So there might be historical stuff still sitting behind that, but maybe not, we don't necessarily get a stronger sense of the community maybe.
No.
Yeah.
And then we have obviously overlaid with that as part of a Reformed tradition.
Yes. Has our Reformed tradition got something to say about James, Fran? What would that be?
One or two things. Well, you know, Martin Luther calling an epistle of straw. Yes. So Reformer Martin Luther did not like James at all. So I think we come to it with some fairly stark presuppositions as well.
Which could also be that we've come to it with an assumption that we really like it because we think it's going to be about like where the rubber hits the road or kind of thing. So, I mean, there could be a trap in either direction
Definitely,
right?
Yes, yeah. So I think we'll start with looking at the text as we generally do. I'm struck with just the opening verse, and this opening verse I think does start to dismantle some of our presuppositions about James is saying. Every generous act of giving with every perfect gift is from above, coming from the Father of light. So I suppose I'd say two things. Can you see a Hellenistic sort of a background here with the Father of Lights being the phrase, but also that these things we're being asked to do shortly are not actually primarily or firstly out of our own effort or inherent goodness at all. They're out of God. Whereas I think that perhaps that bit's been forgotten about James.
I think that exactly. I think people really focus on stuff like, you know, that it doesn't talk about Jesus and it talks about doing all the time. And these two kind of caricatures really, the ways that fits into a caricature of James ends up being an assumption that it's about doing that is disconnected from certain kinds of faith. And obviously we get here right from the get-go that that's not what it's not really disconnected from that.
I think a challenge, a big picture challenge here, like with preaching, our sermons are to be about God, right?
Yes.
You know, whereas this passage looks like it's asking us to do the opposite of that. It's all about getting us, you know, the imperative and all of that. I still think it's a challenge to keep in mind. Yeah. What does this say about God?
Yes.
What are you going to preach about God from this passage?
Well, and I think, but the passage does set us up with that, right? There's still things to say about God in framing this. You know, I think it's, obviously we're going to get to a verse and a tick that talks about being doers of the word and not merely hearers who deceive themselves. But I mean, I think it's interesting to me that, you know, before we get to that, three verses before, we still have this, we have further framing building on from what Fran's just been saying, to that you must understand this, my beloved, let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger, for your anger does not produce God's righteousness. So there is a this listening idea, and you know, the word akouo, the word for listen, is also the same word as to obey. So there is this sense of, you're not just when you're going to come to being a doer, it's not just doing disconnected from these things. It's obeying. It's heeding what one has already heard, and the invitation is to stop and to listen properly, to be slow, you know, quick to listen, but slow to speak, to like reflect on what we're hearing.
And maybe in Markan terms, with the heart.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Listening with the heart.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not in this particular reading.
Yeah.
And I think in our own culture, especially our social media worlds and so on, we're not very quick to listen. Yeah, and, yeah, you know, yeah. We are very quick to comment and judge and to express outrage. Like, that's become really quite dominant in ways that maybe it's always been there, but a lot hidden. So, yeah, when I talk about underlining that stuff coming from God, it's not to diminish the call on us to, I don't know, act in a godly way.
Yeah,
the risk
of
sounding overly pious. You know,
no.
It's not to diminish that necessity to act in accordance with,
yes,
you know, your heart oriented to God.
Yes. No, well, and I mean, it's really interesting how frequently in James we get language about testing, and we get language about deceiving. And here we have it about being hearers who deceive themselves, which sounds like it's not really the hearing itself that is unhelpful, because, of course, we're being told already to be quick to listen, but something about self-justification or something, which could be really at the root of a lot of this trouble, I suspect, in James anyway.
Yeah, and I think that's what speaks to us as well. Like, I think, again, we're in a church culture, in a Western liberal church here in Australia, that we go to action very easily. And we do that because we might be embarrassed by the core of the gospel in the face of the culture, or we might think it's not as important as the doing bits of it. And then we want to go and measure whether we're doing enough, and then I'll judge you whether you are.
Yeah.
And we get in this
and judge
awful,
ourselves.
And judge
right,
ourselves.
So it becomes really
none
toxic.
None of which is liberating or remotely gospel.
Yeah.
And then we've got this other, you know, debate or dilemma around, well, obviously good stuff can be done outside of God, you know, so what's the difference if we, you know, for us to do it? I mean, James would say, I think, clearly that it is only within God that good things are done.
Yeah.
Which is that's what it says, but, you know, how would we talk about
saying that?
That
every good thing comes through. Yeah, well, yeah, and yeah. How, as people of faith, we can be grounded in that sense of the good that God is wanting to do through us. I mean, I think going back to the, the inheritance we have of like both a Reformation inheritance about how we hear James, and whether we think of Martin Luther's criticism as being a point against James or a point in James's favour. Some of us might be thinking that exactly what he didn't like is exactly what we're after. And also going back to that very early church tradition about this conflict between Paul and the Jerusalem church with James as its head, you know, how we see that. I suspect it's possible for us to overlay over all of these texts a really false dichotomy, which could at both ends be quite negative. Like, it's kind of like the rubbish version of it at both sides of the dichotomy. It would be, on the one hand, a kind of works righteousness, which is, of course, what Martin Luther was wanting to criticize James for being. And at the other hand, a kind of cheap grace, which is how we might think some interpretations of Paul could get us, right? Yeah, and whereas neither of them actually give a really authentic credence to what I suspect both parts of this tradition are trying to communicate, which is both the radical, liberating, universe-altering nature of God's love enacted through Christ. That means that we are free from that stuff through God's grace. And at the same time, something that is, because the world has been so altered through this, there's nothing that we can, we can't really hold ourselves back from living as changed people in that changed world.
No, so you're living as, so what motivates us is then the reconciling love of God between yes. each other.
Yes.
And not a motivation to prove God or a motivation to the world, that
That's
is,
right.
and not a motivation to prove that we're good enough to God.
Yeah.
So it's seeing God very differently
yeah.
in that relationship. It's and then it's also recognizing that, you know, through the crucified one, that what we do will be inadequate, but mm-hmm. that God is enough to redeem that and to do God's work with it and in spite of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the law. Well, that's what I see the law of liberty.
Yes, the perfect law, right? This is what James says, the perfect law, the law of liberty. It's a freedom within a way of living out faith that makes sense here. And I was thinking maybe it's more than a dichotomy, the kind of false different ways that you can engage with this kind of hard connection of issues, because I think one of the things we've spoken about on the podcast before, Fran, is about the way in which our tradition can even make faith a work. You know,
yeah.
when you get this conversation about have I been faithful enough, it's like we've kind of contrasted faith and works and yet still made faith something that you have to kind of clear the bar on or something rather than something which is given, and that we will our way into it, but it is still ultimately a recognition of the liberty, of the freedom that we're given in that and grace.
Well, I think that's a nice place to end. Thanks for listening, folks.
Thank you.
By the Well has been recorded on Wurundjeri land. It's produced by Adrian Jackson and brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia.